From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Love him or hate him, Attorney General John Ashcroft is an unflinching presence in American politics today. In this hour, how his religion defines his political and personal life, and why some in Washington say he could be George W. Bush's running mate in 2004. First, pressure is mounting for the resignation of Boston's Cardinal Bernard Law. Today, the editorial pages of the Boston Globe and New Hampshire's union leader both called for Law to step down. Kevin Cullen is part of the Boston Globe investigative unit that's been steadily uncovering the priest sex scandal. I asked him what's driven the push for a resignation to its new pitch.
I think the disclosures in the Shanley case on Monday have brought this to a new level. This is obviously a scandal that has reverberated here in Boston since January, the initial Globe Spotlight series, and then has reverberated and spread across the nation and other parts of the globe. But the Shanley disclosures, the level to which the Cardinal and his deputies went to hide this information, the level of depravity contained in these documents, I think has brought it to a new level, and I think that this is the straw that broke the camel's back on a lot of people that were hanging in there with the Cardinal.
Kevin Cullen, for our listeners around the country, can you give us in a nutshell what was so devastating about the Shanley case?
First of all, I think it was the number of times that the Cardinal and his deputies were warned about the depravities of Father Shanley, and that Father Shanley had openly endorsed sexual relations between men and boys.
And this was a priest in the Boston Archdiocese who was then transferred to California without any warning from the Boston folks that this guy had a difficult history.
Yeah, that was the other thing. The idea of foisting him upon another diocese and actually vouching for his integrity. Not only did they know there were allegations, they had actually paid settlements to people on the condition that they keep their mouths shut when they alleged abuse at the hands of Father Shanley. So it's not as if that they did not know about this person's past.
How does this particular case go specifically to the credibility of Cardinal Bernard Law?
When you compare it to the initial case, the sort of whatever I call the rock slide that led to the avalanche here is the John Gagan case, the priest who had been just shuttled around from parish to parish, which allowed him to molest a whole new set of children every time he went from one parish to another. That, at the time, the Cardinal was able to say that, well, it was 1984. I didn't quite know. I just got here. Then it was 1986. I really didn't know to the extent of pedophilia being such a incurable problem. The difference here in the Shanley case, I think, is that the dates involved, you're talking about things that happened, you know, as recently as 1997, mm-hmm. long after the Archdiocese had paid money to several of Shanley's victims. Cardinal Law did not object to Father Shanley's application to be the director of a church-run guest house in New York City, which was frequented by teenage students. Mm-hmm. And what it suggests also is, beyond the Gagan case, which was so dramatic when it first unfolded, is the pattern here, that this isn't isolated, that this isn't an aberration, that there are many priests. Since the Gagan case broke in January of this year, the initial Spotlight series reports, there have been just priest after priest whose cases are similar to this.
And the Cardinal had to know.
Well, clearly he knew, because we have documents showing that he was moving these priests around, that the response to allegations here was to pay victims on the condition they kept quiet and then move the priests onto unsuspecting parishes.
Kevin Cullen, what is the level of the call for Cardinal Law's resignation now? How would you describe it?
Well, I'd say it has definitely ratcheted up, and it goes across the board. We had a story in today's paper which noted some of the more prominent Catholics in this region, such as Jack Connors, a very big power player in Boston, and also Tom O'Neill, the son of the late House Speaker Tip O'Neill, who's a prominent Catholic. Tom O'Neill was one of the people, along with Jack Connors, who the Cardinal sought advice from in a very dramatic fashion, sitting around the table at the Chancery 2 months ago. And now you have people there who were at that meeting who the cardinal, obviously, whose counsel he values, they are the ones now publicly saying he should go.
And if the cardinal should go, Kevin, how exactly does that happen? Is there any precedent for this? Who would take his place?
The most striking precedent in this area was set down just last week by a bishop in Ireland named Brendan Comiskey. He was the first bishop that we know of who voluntarily stepped down because he accepted that he had done not enough to control a pedophile priest in his domain. Bishop Comiskey tendered his resignation and personally flew to Rome to make sure that it was accepted by the Pope because, mm-hmm. as Cardinal Law pointed out, it really wasn't for him. It was for the Pope to decide.
Kevin, this seems extreme, but the Attorney General's office in Massachusetts has been paying a lot of very public attention to these cases and this case. Is there any threat of criminal action against a cardinal here?
Well, I talked to the Attorney General, Tom Riley, yesterday, and he was being very careful because not only talking to Tom Riley, but talking to various district attorneys here who have handled these cases, they all seem to think that the statutes in Massachusetts don't cover this sort of thing. It's very difficult. You have to prove a criminal intent. So it's beyond saying the cardinal should have known putting a pedophile here he was likely to abuse again. The interesting thing is that the Attorney General here has floated and confirmed they are looking at the civil rights statute in Massachusetts, which is the broadest in the country. And it's a tool that can be used very widely. You can kind of make it do whatever you want to make it do.
Against an individual or a class of individuals?
It would be citing the civil rights violations, not of an individual, but a group of individuals. In this case, vulnerable children. The Attorney General could be just in a situation, you know, do you want to try me? The threat of criminal charges could be as effective from a prosecutorial point of view as the actual filing of criminal charges.
And finally, Kevin, have you heard anything there to suggest that Cardinal Bernard Law might indeed step down in the near future?
No, Tommy. I mean, you hear rumors everywhere, here and there. It's only the man himself can answer that question. And as Dave D'Alessandro mentioned, a businessman who would call for his resignation, when it comes to Cardinal Law, he's not taking our calls.
Kevin Cullen is a reporter with the Boston Globe. Tonight, in our occasional On Point series profiling members of the Bush administration, we're looking at Attorney General John Ashcroft, the son of a Pentecostal minister. He's the most socially conservative figure to hold the office of Attorney General in decades. His supporters say he's rebuilding the image of a Justice Department sullied under Janet Reno. Critics accuse him of using the cloak of anti-terrorism to further his own right-wing agenda on abortion and gun control in Washington. John Ashcroft came into office as the most contentious nominee of the Bush cabinet, but 9/11 elevated him to the high plane of Colin Powell and Donald Rumsfeld. He's gained strong support for his hardline policies from the White House and the public. He's enjoying a 76% public approval rating right now. He's talking tough on the evening news and schmoozing with David Letterman on The Late Show. Suddenly, the political future of John Ashcroft looks bright. What does that tell us about the man and our moment in history? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. Joining me from New York City is Jeffrey Toobin, author of A Vast Conspiracy and Too Close to Call, The 36-Day Battle to Decide the 2000 Election. His profile of Attorney General John Ashcroft appears in this week's New Yorker magazine. Good evening and welcome, Jeffrey Toobin.
Hi, Tom.
Hi, great to have you with us again, Jeffrey.
Great to be back.
Jeffrey, you have laid out an awful lot of new detail. We thought we knew the story of John Ashcroft, and yet you brought it to life here in a whole new way. One detail that really caught my eye, you describe going through the vast halls of the Justice Department, room after room, receptionist after receptionist, finally getting to the relatively modest office of John Ashcroft, and in front of his desk there was just one picture on the wall. Describe it for us.
Well, it's a photograph of Barbara Olson, who was the wife of Ashcroft's Solicitor General, Ted Olson, and she was also a very familiar figure to cable television watchers, a harsh and devoted critic of the Clinton administration. She is in the photograph is speaking at a Confirm Ashcroft rally that took place during his confirmation hearings last January. Mm. She, of course, was one of the people killed on the plane that flew into the Pentagon on September 11th. And what struck me as interesting about that photograph is that Barbara Olson sort of captures both sides of John Ashcroft's world. You know, she was a devoted political colleague in the right wing of the Reagan Bush Republican Party, and at the same time, she is a figure from 9/11, the event that has propelled Ashcroft to such enormous prominence.
So you can't say that John Ashcroft is monomaniacal. He's got at least two agendas here: one, a very conservative view of society and political agenda; the other, a very determined attack on the sources that he sees them of terror.
Yeah, I'm not sure they are separate or contradictory, but both of them at the moment are working very harmoniously together. He is both leading the war against terrorism, and he is simultaneously pushing the Justice Department in a more conservative direction than it's gone, at least since the Reagan administration and perhaps before then.
Jeffrey Toobin, we're going to dig into some of the background that made this man tonight, but give us your snapshot at the moment of John Ashcroft's political standing in Washington and in the nation. He came in through very stormy weather. How is John Ashcroft doing today?
Well, this is a story of an enormous political renaissance. A year and a half ago, John Ashcroft lost for re-election to the Senate to a candidate who, on Election Day, had been dead for 3 weeks. 2 months later, he was confirmed for Attorney General with 42 votes against him, the most ever against an attorney general. Today, he has a 76% approval record rating. He is being talked about as a possible replacement for Dick Cheney if he's unable to run for re-election. He has political action committees that are still working on his behalf, and I think he has suddenly become a very serious possible national candidate. You know, will he run in 2004 or 2008? I can't say for sure. But just that the idea that we're talking about it shows how far he's come so quickly.
And as you point out in great detail in your piece, this is a man who's lost and come back before, and each time come back higher than before.
You know, I've covered politics, and I have never heard a story like Ashcroft's in that respect. I mean, in 1972, he lost a race for Congress, got appointed state auditor, fourth highest ranking post in Missouri. 2 years later, he lost for re-election, but wound up being attorney general of the state. After two terms as governor, he lost the race for Republican National Committee chair, but wound up becoming a U.S. senator. He loses for re-election to the Senate and becomes attorney general. What's especially interesting about that story is how he tells it when he talks to conservative and evangelical publications. He says very clearly, these electoral defeats were crucifixions for me, and each time after I was crucified, I was resurrected. I mean, there are not many people in public life who talk about themselves in those explicitly religious terms and explicitly Christ-like terms, but that's John Ashcroft, and it was frankly amazing to me.
And this man who uses that language and who has a very devout, it's more than a religious stripe, it's a religious foundation, is also pushing U.S. law enforcement in a whole new way. You write that he's pushing the central element of anti-terrorism strategy with a shift from an emphasis of investigating completed crimes to preventing future crimes, a shift that will change the way the federal government investigates crime.
It's just, you know, I'm a former prosecutor, and a federal prosecutor, and I have a sense of how federal law enforcement works. And even with the most serious crimes, like, you know, organized crime or espionage, the plan always was, you know, catch them in the act, catch them talking about things, you know, arrest them after the crime has been completed. This is a completely new world we're in, where the potential crimes are such magnitude that you simply can't wait for the crime to take place.
Jeff Toobin, stand by. We've got to take a short break. We're going to come back and talk about John Ashcroft's history and the implications of his law enforcement policy. What do you see in John Ashcroft? Guardian at the gate or menace to civil liberties? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about Attorney General John Ashcroft tonight on Point. Here's a clip from his appearance last night on The Late Show with David Letterman.
Have you tapped my phone? Seriously, have you ever tapped my phone? Because, I, you know, sometimes late at night I call some of those numbers, you know, the deals. And then I hear, like, things going on and I think, oh, but, you know, you don't really want to hang up.
That was... Yeah. That was me snoring.
I see.
I listen until I get bored, and then I
can't.
He's the Attorney General, and he's riding high in the poll numbers. He's also the most conservative politician to hold that post, perhaps in decades. What does John Ashcroft's tremendous popularity in the polls tell you about America's state of mind? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We are joined by Jeffrey Toobin. He's a New Yorker writer with a great article in this week's New Yorker magazine. He's also author of A Vast Conspiracy and Too Close to Call, The 36-Day Battle to Decide the 2000 Elections. Jeffrey Toobin, we hear there with David Letterman. Letterman, as usual, getting in a roundabout way to what's on a lot of people's minds about the what's perceived as a more intrusive approach by this attorney general, as a man who's on such a mission that he's willing to trample on civil liberties a bit, if necessary, to get it done. But is that a fair assessment?
Well, you know, I think all you need to do is see how his Democratic critics have retreated so quickly on the civil liberties issue to see that most Americans don't feel that civil liberties are being trampled. You know, the USA Patriot Act, which was the law that was passed immediately in the aftermath of 9/11, you know, it is not, I think, a comparable crackdown on civil liberties to the internment of the Japanese or the Palmer raids after World War One. I mean, yes, they have made it easier to wiretap phones and cell phones and you know, all the new technology. But there has not been a crackdown that I think most Americans are worried about. You know, for example, also one of the controversial issues was the military tribunals that were announced.
Mm-hmm.
And when they were first announced by the White House, it seemed like it was possible that there would be death sentences on less than unanimous verdicts, no appeals process at all. But when the Defense Department released the formal proposal, some of it had been moderated to a significant degree. There was an appeals process. The death sentences would have to be unanimous. And, of course, there haven't been any military tribunals yet. So I think a combination of the public truly willing to see some sacrifice of privacy to allow the war on terrorism to continue, and also some scaling back of the more extreme proposals has muted a lot of the criticism.
Mm-hmm. You write that John Ashcroft is not shy about appearing to help mute that criticism. And when he was before the Senate Judiciary Committee on December 6th, he launched into a hearing there before senators who had not only a year earlier who had been giving him a really rough time. He launched in so effectively that he essentially shut down a whole panel of U.S. senators who had come to criticize and dig and found themselves really muted.
Well, it was really an extraordinary moment. You know, in his prepared statement, he said those who criticize our proposals on civil liberties grounds were giving aid and comfort to our enemies. Now, I'm paraphrasing, but I'm not paraphrasing much. And, you know, the idea that mere criticism of him amounted to helping the enemy was just incredible to me. Yet none of the senators called him on it in any serious way. Again, a demonstration of how afraid Democratic politicians are of seeming soft on terrorism.
And in John Ashcroft's view, I guess, he's slapping the country awake and saying, look, this really happened and we cannot afford to let it happen again. We've got to change our ways. He doesn't pull any punches about really wanting to change the way things work.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, what is difficult to discern at this point is just how far we're going to go in changing the way we live our lives to accommodate this recognition of the threat. But you know, Ashcroft is going to push it as hard and as far as he can go, because, you know, as Ashcroft tells the story very dramatically, and he talks about it to his staff all the time, you know, the day after 9/11, President Bush called Ashcroft into his office and said, John, you simply cannot let something like this happen again. And that is the issue in the Justice Department now. And, you know, the public feels much the same way.
Mm. Question is, John Ashcroft wants to stop crimes before they're committed, especially terrorist crimes. What does that mean for American safety? What does that mean for American civil liberty? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. Jeffrey Toobin, you describe these great scenes John Ashcroft's history, his grandfather, immigrant from Ireland, the paternal grandfather, driving his 1921 Chevrolet with an oilcloth sign tacked to the side reading, "Where will you spend eternity?" Snapshots of John Ashcroft playing pickup basketball with Clarence Thomas when he was a young man on the staff of later John Danforth of Missouri. There's a long history here of conservatism and deep religious conviction.
You know, John Ashcroft comes from this really extraordinary family that is almost the first family of the Assemblies of God, which is part of the Pentecostal movement. And his grandfather was literally a street corner minister, someone who used to preach on street corners around on the country, sometimes being pelted by tomatoes. But, you know, he persevered, and the Assemblies of God grew from a very marginal small church into a very fast-growing denomination. Unfortunately, it's probably best known now as the Church of Jimmy Swaggart and Jim and Tammy Faye Baker. But, you know, it became this big institution. And, you know, to me, a very important moment was when John Ashcroft's father, Robert Ashcroft, in World War II, decided he wanted to become a military chaplain. But he was rejected because the Assemblies of God didn't believe in sending people to secular schools and getting college degrees. And Robert Ashcroft became a pioneer in integrating the evangelical movement into sort of mainstream American education. And you can, in many respects, you can look at John Ashcroft's career, the Attorney General's career, as integrating American politics into the Assemblies of God, the way his father integrated education. You know, he has never given up the fervor of his beliefs, and it has shaped his opinions on many issues, most notably abortion. But, you know, Ashcroft has managed simultaneously to be a true evangelical conservative of the strongest degree, and at the same time, a very successful politician.
Broke out of the parochial education world, went to Yale on a football scholarship, went to the University of Chicago Law School on the basis of great performance at Yale. You describe an extraordinary moment on the morning before John Ashcroft was sworn in as U.S. Senator, when friends and family gathered at a house near the Capitol. I think of it as the Crisco moment or the anointment moment. Tell us about that.
Well, I mean, yeah, this was like something out of a movie. John Ashcroft's father was 83 years old, in poor health, but he came to Washington to see his son sworn in as a senator. And there's a tradition in the evangelical movement, in the Assemblies of God, observed only by the most devout people, where people about to experience important moments in their lives are literally anointed with oil in a quasi-biblical ceremony. And they weren't going to do it, but John Ashcroft's father suggested that they do it. And they anointed John Ashcroft with Crisco oil that they found in this apartment in Washington. And at that moment, John Ashcroft's father struggled to get off the couch to participate in the ceremony. And Ashcroft said to his father, "Dad, it's okay. You don't have to, you know, you don't have to get up. You don't have to struggle to stand up." And he said, "I'm not struggling to stand. I'm struggling to kneel." Hmm. And later that night, his father died. It's just, you know, it's out of a movie.
it's out of the Bible, that's for sure, or at least the strong echoes. And here is this American moment, a tremendously conservative American attorney general riding a huge wave of popularity for the stern face he's showing to terrorism, and now seen as a man with very strong potential political future life, even after all the defeats he's suffered. You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. Ellen is on the line. Welcome, Ellen. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
This is the scariest guy I've seen come along since Joe McCarthy. And
what scares you, Ellen? Why?
I'm old enough to remember the McCarthy era. Well, your guest has talked about John Ashcroft's the author of the USA Patriot Act, in which civil liberties have been abrogated. I would add to what your guest has said that, in fact, there are some hundreds, and your guest can, you know, correct my figures for me. He's more familiar with them than I am. Hundreds of people in jail, I think, mainly people of Arab descent, many held without habeas corpus. There's an erosion of the Bill of Rights that has just very steeply happened under this administration, and that some of us are really afraid is going to go on precipitously, escalating to the point where we may have another McCarthy period, or we may have another period like the late teens and the early 20s, when Attorney General Mitchell Palmer deported many people simply because of their political affiliation.
But Ellen, don't you want, after 9/11, a fierce defender in the office of Attorney General for this country?
I would like a rational and sane person who is not the U.S. counterpart of a kind of American Taliban person. I would like somebody who, as a matter of fact, would see to it that our intelligence services be reformed such that, for example, they are not wiretapping people like me who are on the left, but rather are seeing to their own house. The FBI is in a scandalous shape.
Ellen, we've got it. You've given us a lot to chew on there, and I thank you for your call. Jeffrey Toobin, let's just march right through that. And I guess one phrase that comes to mind, Ellen wants a rational and sane Attorney General. Do you see anything lacking on John Ashcroft's part in that?
I think you have to remember, when you talk about something like the USA Patriot Act, it passed the Senate 99-1
sure
with
did.
The support of people like Ted Kennedy and John Kerry and you know, the people who are not notorious conservatives.
Well, and take it straight on. You've sat with this man very recently in his offices. He's conservative and he's religious, but is there anything missing in the rational and sane department?
Well, I think it would be unfair to characterize him as either irrational or insane. I mean, that's just simply not the case.
McCarthy period.
McCarthy, I think it's an overstatement. Ellen said that, you know, people are being held without habeas corpus. Well, that's not true. I mean, they are. Everyone who's being held has access to a lawyer. Everyone is being held on some charges or another. You know, I think if people are going to wind up criticizing Ashcroft for extremism, it's not going to be because of anti-terrorism. It's going to be because of the other baggage he brought to the job, most notably abortion and gun control. That's where I think he is politically most vulnerable. On terrorism, I think it's going to be a losing battle to attack him.
So you're saying the issue of the erosion of the Bill of Rights is a hard one to sustain?
Well, I think it's both a hard one to sustain politically in the current environment. I also think...
Well, but that doesn't mean that there's not an erosion. Are you saying
it's just a
relativism issue here?
No, I think...
Or is there erosion?
Well, you know, I think there has been no substantial erosion. I think there has been some sacrifice required of privacy by things like the USA Patriot Act. But I don't think it is a fair comparison to say that the USA Patriot Act is like McCarthyism or the Palmer Raids. I think, you know, you have to make distinctions that are rational, and it is simply not the case that this, at least in my opinion, that this law erodes civil liberties to anywhere near the degree that those other things did.
Tough times, strange times. Patrick is on the line. Welcome, Patrick. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Happy to.
I would like to – I do fear that we are going through an erosion of our Bill of Rights currently, but I would like to suggest a context with which we look at that in, and then I'd love to hear your comments on it. I think our nation wants to do great things, and I think we want our people to be free, and I think we want to be, you know, great things for people. I think that nations, though, like individuals, go through what I would equate to a Maslow's hierarchy of needs. Mm-hmm. And at our most basic needs level, we have to be secure. We have to be secure in our homes and secure in our work and our work environment and things like that. And 9/11 has made us feel insecure. So we've rolled back from the higher order roots of our civil rights and our freedoms and all the things that have made this country great. And I think we've rolled back to a lower level need that says we must be secure at, you know, pretty close to any cost.
Does that make you nervous about the fundamental things America stands for, Patrick?
It makes me nervous except for, well, it doesn't, it doesn't. I think that just like it would be foolish to think about putting a man on the moon if you didn't have food to eat, I think it would also be foolish for us to not consider what we should do given what happened on 9/11. What gives me faith in our nation is that I do believe that as we become secure again and as we deal with these problems, we will roll back and the pendulum will swing back to where our civil liberties and the Bill of Rights will again become a main concern.
Patrick,
again,
thanks for your call. I want to turn that over to Jeffrey Toobin. Could there be a different balance right now, or is it the John Ashcroft's conservative coloring outside his actual law enforcement practice, as you're saying, Jeffrey Toobin, that's arousing this concern?
You know, I had an interesting conversation, which I quote in the piece, with Nadine Strossen, who's the president of the American Civil Liberties Union, who said, you know, this erosion of civil liberties would be going on regardless of who was president, regardless of who was attorney general. This is simply what happens when the country faces an acute crisis like this one.
But when it's John Ashcroft driving, doesn't that mean he could push, as you say, the rest of his agenda on abortion, on gun control, right along with his law enforcement agenda?
And that's why it matters that John Ashcroft is attorney general. That's why it's important that he's there and not someone else. Because a lot of the anti-terrorism effort is very much bipartisan. It is also, I think, just on an objective basis, has not been a tremendous intrusion on you know the nation's civil liberties. But I think what makes John Ashcroft so different from Janet Reno or even Ed Meese is that this is a man who used to say in speeches that if I could only change one law in the United States, it would be to make abortion illegal. Mm-hmm. And that is a guiding principle of his life. He is doing what he can on the issue now within the constraints of, you know, Roe v. Wade being the law of the land. But that is why it matters that he's attorney general. And I think, frankly, the civil liberty side of things would largely be happening regardless of who was there.
Jeff Toobin, stand by. We're going into a break. We're at 1-800-423-8255. We'll go in here listening to John Ashcroft singing a song he wrote, Let the Eagle Soar.
To golden shore, let the mighty eagle soar, soar with healing in her wings, as the land beneath her sings. Only God, no other king. Let the mighty eagle soar.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about U.S. Attorney General John Ashcroft with Jeffrey Toobin, New Yorker writer and attorney himself. So we're wondering, there's now talk of John Ashcroft as George W. Bush's vice presidential running mate in 2004. Can you see it? And I guess in a broader way, in a dangerous century, is John Ashcroft's conservative view the nation's future? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. Yesterday, Ashcroft announced charges that a New York lawyer had helped her client, an Egyptian sheikh, to direct terrorist operations from prison. Let's listen.
Before being allowed access to Rockman, his attorneys, including Lynn Stewart, were required to sign and did sign an affirmation acknowledging that they would abide by these measures and they would be accompanied by translators only to communicate with Sheikh Rahman according to and regarding legal matters. Today's indictment charges that Lynn Stewart and Mohammed Yousri repeatedly and willfully violated these orders in order to maintain Sheikh Abdul Rahman's influence over the terrorist activities of the Islamic group.
There's Attorney General John Ashcroft announcing charges yesterday against lawyer Lynn Stewart for helping her client, Sheikh Omar Abdel Rahman, to direct terrorist operations, allegedly. Jeffrey Toobin, how big a shakeup is this for the legal defender community?
Well, it's an enormously complex and difficult issue. I mean, it is clear that lawyers are allowed to advise client. In fact, that's their duty. They are not allowed to participate in the continuing criminal activities of their clients. And there is a history of litigation over what the difference is between giving legal advice to a client and participating in a client's continuing criminal enterprise. What makes this especially complicated is because of recent laws or regulations that Ashcroft put forward, certain attorney-client conversations are now monitored, and both the attorney and the client are warned in advance. But the charge here is that Lynn Stewart, notwithstanding being warned that the conversations were being taped, tried to circumvent the rules and allow the Sheikh Rahman, who is the famous blind sheikh from the World Trade Center case, to continue running his terrorist enterprise. I think it's going to be a bitterly fought case, but it just shows how far the Justice Department is going to go to stop terrorists, what they say are terrorists, from communicating and furthering their activities.
This is an attorney who's been around. She represented mafia turncoat Salvatore Sammy the Bull Gravano, so she knows tough crowds. Will this charge by the Attorney General's office have a chilling effect on attorney-client relations? Are attorneys going to be afraid to talk to their clients in jail?
Well, I think you have to just, again, draw a distinction here. This Sheikh Rahman was one of the very few people, I think it was only 16 in the whole federal system, whose conversations with their attorneys are monitored. I mean, it is, both sides are told that. So I don't think most attorneys have anything to worry about who are not being monitored. But one of the most effective moments in Ashcroft's testimony before the Senate Judiciary Committee, with which I begin my New Yorker piece, is he took out a real Al-Qaeda training manual, and he read from it, and he said, they advise their incarcerated compatriots to use their lawyers to communicate their plans to the outside world. That is, A, illegal, and B, pretty darn persuasive that it's worth doing something about. Now, I don't know whether Lynn Stewart's guilty or innocent, but the fact that she's being prosecuted does not tell me that all attorneys and all clients have a great deal to worry about.
We're talking with writer Jeffrey Toobin about U.S. Attorney General John Ashcroft. Bob's on the line. Welcome, Bob. You're on the air.
Thank you. I wanted to speak to Attorney General Ashcroft's approval rating. My sense is that Americans approve of him at the rate that they do because most people believe that they're law-abiding citizens, and they feel that that they're immune from the negative effects of Ashcroft's brand of ultra-aggressive law enforcement
immune to that, but not necessarily immune to terrorism, and so they accept it.
Yes, that's correct. But I think that's not a realistic assessment that people make. I think that it takes a very special sort of attorney general to be the custodian of the kind of power that Americans feel that it is necessary to bestow upon that office, in the current context. And I think John Ashcroft is a very dangerous person to hold the reins at a time like this, and I think that people should not feel so secure that if they are wrongly accused of a crime or if they are wrongly suspected of a crime that they themselves will not suffer the effects of a zealot like Ashcroft.
We've got it, Bob, and thanks for your call. I want to go right to David. Welcome, David. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was listening to the conversation. I was beginning to think the scariest thing I could think of would be John Ashcroft, vice president, but I actually think John Ashcroft, singer-songwriter, is even more scary.
That was David Letterman's show last night. Watch out.
But I wanted to pose a speculative question to Mr. Toobin and it builds on a couple of the other callers talking about the current environment, and I think it's easy for anyone who is fairly conservative or very aggressive to be successful in this environment, but clearly he has some skill. I'd like him to speculate a couple years out after maybe some of the 9/11 fervor has died down and people really start to assess what's going on, what his future may be.
Jeffrey Toobin.
Well, I think, with the caveat that obviously I don't know for sure, I think the contemporary Republican Party believes in a couple things. They believe that abortion should be illegal. The Republican Party is a pro-life party. And the people who think that George Bush is going to pick Colin Powell, Tom Ridge, Condoleezza Rice as his vice president, if he's in the market for a vice president in 2 years, are simply dreaming. There is never going to be a pro-choice national nominee in this Republican Party. So you have to look at who are the pro-life possibilities. And I think Ashcroft, at the moment, you know, true, 9/11 will fade. You know, one hopes that there won't be anything comparable happening in the United States in the next couple of years. But it is such an enormous event that anyone associated with it will remain prominent. And I think there is no one comparable in the Republican Party now, in the pro-life wing of the party, who's as prominent or as popular as Ashcroft. So, you know, am I sitting here guaranteeing he's going to replace Cheney? No. But I think he will be a very serious possibility.
Give us Karl Rove's calculus on that right-wing base.
Well, again, a very interesting speech he gave, a little notice speech. Karl Rove, of course, as your listeners know, is President Bush's chief political lieutenant. And he gave a speech and he said, you know, the real problem for the Republicans in the 2000 presidential election was not that we failed to reach out sufficiently to the middle of the political spectrum. He said there were 4 to 5 million evangelicals who did not vote at all. That's our room for growth. So if you feel like the way to build your number is through appealing more to the right, to the evangelical community, who better to bring to the ticket than John Ashcroft? Just to add another point, you know, the one thing that haunts everyone in the Bush administration is the experience of the first President Bush in 1992, who they believe lost in large part because they were challenged from the right by Pat Buchanan in the primaries. They are determined not to let that happen again. If you had an Ashcroft or someone of his political stripe as the vice presidential nominee, you guarantee no challenge from the right, and then you let President Bush run to the middle during the general election.
Jeffrey Toobin, 10 seconds left. I got the feeling you're a bit taken with this man.
Well, you know, I didn't expect to like him as much as he did, and I'm not saying it's a good thing that he's been so prominent, but I think it is worth saying that he has been enormously politically successful so far against all odds.
Jeffrey Toobin, thanks so much for being with us tonight. Really appreciate it.
Thanks, Tom.
Jeff Toobin is author of a profile of John Ashcroft in this week's New Yorker magazine. We're going to go out listening to John Ashcroft last night on David Letterman playing on the piano Can't Buy Me Love. For ongoing coverage of the day's news, visit our website. The address is onpointradio.org. In a moment, the Royals are people too. This is On Point. Yesterday, about 1 million people lined the streets of London to pay their respects as the hearse carrying the Queen Mother passed by. If Ian Lester were in his hometown of Manchester, England, he probably would have made the hours-long trip by train to London to join the crowd, but he's too far away. Instead, from his home in Rhode Island, he checks the web several times a day to keep up with the news at home, and he tries to describe to his American friends why he's a proud monarchist. In this diary, Ian Lester talks about how his Queen Mother has changed, touched his life, and how a brush with the royals brought these biggest of British celebrities down to human scale.
Down Route 1, there's a farm called Lily May Farms, and I guess there's some British connection there because they fly three flags, the Rhode Island state flag, the Stars and Stripes, and the Union flag. as I'm coming up to it, I see one flag flying at half-mast, and as I get a little bit closer, I realise it's the Union flag. It's my flag flying at half-mast by itself, and it was just an incredibly sad moment to see it there flying half-mast, honouring the Queen Mother. I only avoided tears by calling my fiancé on the cell phone. Everybody loved her. I don't think there's anybody who'd ever say a bad thing about the Queen Mother. Recently, her daughter had died, and against doctor's advice, she'd attended the funeral. You know, she wasn't somebody who was going to give up on life. If she wasn't ready to die, then I don't think anybody was ready to see her die. So when people would say, you know, we're sorry to hear about the Queen Mother, I can really turn around and say, yeah, I am upset about it, and really expect them to understand that. That I could be upset about somebody who lived to 101 who I'd never met, who had no direct connection to my life, but it still meant something to me. So I was in a military version of the Boy Scouts, and one of the things you have to do is a 60-mile hike over 5 days, carrying everything that you're going to need. Weeded as in North Wales, and it's not the surface of Mars, but it's pretty rough terrain, and it's also pretty wet terrain, and we definitely got the wet weather. At one point we were walking down a pretty steep hill, and the whole hill was just covered in little streams, and of course as I'm walking down, my boot kind of angles forwards, and one of these little streams pours right down the back of the boot, and I think that was one of my life's low points. At that point I was like, I'm just not going to do this. I'm not going to achieve this. But somehow we got through. Because we achieved that, we got this opportunity to go in one of the royal palaces. I was 20 years old and I'd never been to London. So it was a fantastic opportunity to not just go down as a random tourist, but to go down to St. James's Palace and to meet the Duke of Edinburgh. But we walked in with this string quartet playing, and you know, all the paintings on the walls and everything was just like unimaginable. We saw one of the thrones. It wasn't as grand as you expected. You also expect the throne to be huge. But when you actually see one up close, it's person-sized, which when you think about it, it should be, because a person's going to sit in it. It was quite a small thing, but it was a kind of magical experience. But then it was kind of brought down to earth when Prince Philip, yesterday I saw him on the news in his military uniform, and you know, he was this institution just like the Queen Mother. When he came around and spoke to us, he was, you genuinely thought that when he asked you a question that he cared about the answer. I can't put adequate words to it. It's like they're not just distant people, they're people who make a difference in people's lives, and they made a difference in my life.
Ian Lister lives in East Greenwich, Rhode Island. He spoke with On Point's Michelle Kearns. You can listen to other radio diaries at our website. Log on to onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.